Picture this. You're on a John Deere compact tractor, enjoying the sun as you clear brush across your pasture. You just have to get in the seat. Learn more at johndeere.com/get in the seat or visit a dealer near you.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Scrum Down NBC Sports Rugby Podcast. I am your host with the most, Alex Corbusier, and it is great to be back, everyone. Lots to talk about on this week's episode. It is Six Nations time here in America. That is on NBC Sports. Every game is available live and on demand with Peacock TV, and then replaying on CNBC with this weekend, myself and Dan Lyle covering all the games this weekend. And that's really what the bulk of today's episode is about. We have a lot to talk about. We have Alex Lowe on to start the show, where we recap and go over some of the latest developments in the RFU sort of tackle height story that's been going on. We touched on it last week. There's been more developments, RFU issuing apology, lots to talk about there. And then we turn our focus to the Six Nations. We start with Alex Lowe looking at England, talking about Steve Borthwick's team. Then we move to Blair Cowan, in-person interview. Blair Cowan, ex-Scotland international, New Zealand born, but played for Scotland, now over in San Diego Legion, playing in the MLR. Was able to get him in studio, get his thoughts about Scotland, their Six Nations, what to expect against England, and also how the balance of power has been shifting over these last 5 years, where England have only won one Calcutta Cup out of the last five. And then we have Luke Fitzgerald on, former Ireland international, host of the Left Wing podcast in Ireland, good friend of mine. Of those who've been the diehard Scrum Down-aholics from day one will know Luke was on very early. He's a very successful podcaster, pundit, and also has a lovely family and business life as well in Ireland. And he's really in tune with what's going on over there. And I thought it was good to get an Irish perspective, as Ireland for me this year are my favorites in the Six Nations. I think everyone will be talking about France, and how can you not? Such a good team, home World Cup on the horizon, youth experience. But I think that trip to Dublin, that's going to be the game of the competition. And can France go there and win? I'm not sure. Ireland looks strong to me, and I think that tips me picking Ireland in the Six Nations. But, you know, it's all to play for. France kick off this weekend against Italy. We don't get too much into that game, as I think that's a win for France. Just being honest and upfront with everyone, you never know in Six Nations rugby. But I think we'll get on to more France next week as they have that big showdown with Ireland. But let's get into the show as we kick off with Alex Lowe from The Times, giving us the latest developments in this tackle height story that the RFU have been dealing with. Lots to talk about. Let's get into it. And we are joined again by Alex Lowe from The Times. Alex, you know, it is Six Nations week upon us, but it's still pretty incredible that before we get into that, we've got to be touching on this tackle height law and the community game story that's been unfolding. We touched on it last week, and it's kind of just been snowballing its way along and gaining momentum, twists and turns, as the RFU have done a little bit of a backtrack, have done an apology, and it just seems to be a bit of a PR disaster. Where are we now with everything?
Well, maybe we should start with a full recap. I won't go into all the detail. We had a long chat about it last week, Corbs, but just for anyone who maybe missed last week's episode, there was an announcement by the RFU that the community game, so every level of club rugby, school, university rugby, was going to have the tackle height reduced from the shoulders down to the waist from next season. And it caused an almighty uproar for a number of reasons. Part of it was people who massively disagreed with it being brought right down to the waist. Part of it was the complete lack of consultation with the community game, with the clubs and the referees and the coaches who are going to be required to put this into practice. It triggered a grassroots revolt. The community game were up in arms. There are, and there still are, attempts to call a special general meeting of the RFU so that there could be a vote of no confidence in the chief executive and the board. There were council members. So the RFU council is the body that had to vote this through. There was I guess that the first sign of rebellion was that the clubs of Staffordshire, one of the counties, demanded that their RFU representative goes back to Twickenham and tables a motion for this law to for the vote to be rescinded, for the law to be overturned. Where we got to by Friday, I think we'd have probably spoken on Tuesday or Wednesday, by Friday of last week, the RFU issued an apology and said that they had got the wording wrong, they'd got the communication wrong, and that they would now go out to the game. Staggeringly, we understand that the vote that the council members took was to lower the height of the tackle in the community game. There was no mention of the word waste in that resolution that was passed. Somewhere between the vote happening and the announcement coming out 4 days later, the word waste was inserted into the communication, which is one of the major factors behind the uproar. So the RFU are pushing ahead with plans to lower the height of the tackle in the community game, but they have not now defined where that's going to be to. That will happen in a consultation with the community game. And from my understanding, it's far more likely to be the sternum now rather than the waist. There was also some debate about where the waist actually is, whether it's really your midriff or where you wear your belt. But I think the plan now is to go and talk to those players and those coaches and those referees who are going to have to adapt to this and learn a new way of playing and come back with a resolution that is workable in rugby and keeps people engaged. And from the people I spoke to at the end of last week about the idea of it being the sternum rather than the waist, they were happy with that because there aren't, as they said, there aren't really hardly any high shots in rugby at community level. And if it can remove the head from the same headspace as the ball carrier, then I think that that's likely to be accepted once this process is completed.
It's crazy how much of a fumble, like really the unveiling of this was. And there's been loads of sort of ramifications from it. And the biggest thing for me, or the question, is like, who inserted waste into the press release? Like, where, like, I know they're saying they don't know how it happened, or like what was voted in the meeting didn't have the word waste in, but then the announcement did. Like, if someone's got to take a bit of heat or fall, like, for that, that seems to be one of the biggest sort of catalysts to the uproar. Was it wasn't even we're lowering it to the, which I think the chest or the sternum could, it's in the community game to me, or in junior rugby as well, makes a lot of sense. And I think it's actually not a crazy adjustment with what we know about head injuries, with what we're trying to reduce head on head clashes. It was really the waist and that drop down and the incidents of trying to get all tackles to that point, which I think got a lot of people in uproar, a lot of professionals speaking out that you'll get more concussions. Like, who is to blame for that? Because surely that person is the one who should be getting the real heat.
Well, when I did ask that question of someone on the council, his answer was that he thinks it was inserted in the comms because that's what the French had been using in their trial in the lower league in French rugby. They've had a trial of waist-high tackling with only one person tackles and the ball carrier has to remain upright into contact. That's how it started just before lockdown began. And it's evolved a bit. My understanding is that the referees are less strict. As long as you're below the ball, they were okay with it. Two-man tackles started to come in, but only if the two defenders were in completely different headspace. But that's the one of the trials that's been used to influence this. So the answer I had was because that was the language used in France, it's likely to have been used in this communication. And you're right, there was anger that there was no consultation, but the anger was as much that there was no consultation in what everyone in the community game perceived to be a law change that would fundamentally change the game. You'd have players who felt they could no longer play the game because they were too tall or too stiff or too old to get down and make waist-high tackles in matches. They felt that the rugby was over. Now, sternum is a different matter because you can still, you know, if you're playing vets rugby, you can still do a soak tackle. You can still sort of hug your opposite man and get them to the ground. You can still do, you can still try and do a choke tackle. You can still get man and ball, but you have to be lower than the shoulders. So it takes the head out of or a better chance of taking the head out of the same airspace as the ball carrier's head. So it was a combination of the RFU really trying to do the right thing, trying to make the game safer, trying to look at ways to keep rugby competitive and physical and attractive, but also make it as safe as possible. It came from the right place. The execution of it was so woeful that they triggered, as I said last week, a grassroots revolt, the like of which I've never seen before. The anger and the sadness and the frustration that was sweeping around the game was remarkable, and ended in Friday with a grovelling apology and a climb down, really, from where they had. Even 2 days earlier, they'd been insisting, it's going to be the waist, it's going to be the waist. I kept checking, are you still talking about the waist? They said yes. By Friday, they'd gone, actually, no, we've got this horribly wrong. And so now the consultation process begins.
Like, we talked about it last week, but it seems like, this is my next question to get onto, is they wanted to get ahead of this. They are the ones under the most heat legally right now, with more lawsuits ramping up. It didn't seem a coincidence that there was that amateur lawsuit announced very similar time to this being unveiled in the community game, as a way of almost like PR and optics looking proactive as these things are going to be in the press and under a microscope. That's like the first part. And then the second part on the apology, I don't mean to be cynical as well, but I also feel like the RFU like must have been in absolute disarray, going, we've just about to get like the Six Nations going, home crowds at Twickenham. We've been putting this whole PR campaign of Steve Borthwick, New England, pride back in the jersey, all this stuff. And really, those games at Twickenham are the cash cow of the RFU. And now all of a sudden you see 200 clubs or whatever signing up in revolt. You must be thinking, oh my God, like, panic buttons, apology, get everyone back on side. We need you at Twickenham this weekend for England, Scotland sort of vibe.
Yeah, definitely. And I do think there were people out in the community game who were so cross with what had happened that they draw a direct line between the RFU and the England team, for obvious reasons. The England team is trying to be relaunched under Steve Borthwick. He's told a lot of stories about the first time he ran out to play for England at Twickenham and he felt and heard the roar of the stadium. He's referred to that a lot. That's what he wants to bring back, because if you recall, by the end of the autumn series that England played, there was basically no atmosphere for the Argentina game. And then the end of the South Africa game, there were boos around the stadium, which is never, you'd never heard. There was a lethargy, there was a disconnect. There was a disillusionment around the England team. This new regime, Steve Borthwick, is doing everything he can to build that back, to build this fervour around the national team. And yet out there in the community game, there's division and uproar because of what the RFU had done. They've not made it easy for Steve Borthwick in the first couple of weeks. We had the issue over Owen Farrell's ban and the RFU sort of short-circuiting their own ban and then leaving Steve Borthwick to have to explain it when it wasn't his responsibility. And then we had this tackle height trial law. And amid all the furore, nobody from the RFU spoke. And Steve Borthwick was the first employee to take questions on it. And it's not his decision. So it's been tricky for Steve when he's trying to generate this this real camaraderie and sort of sense of national pride around the team. I mean, which he's only managed to do through words at the moment. They haven't played a game yet. But it's much harder when out there is division and rancour over what the RFU have done.
No, agree, mate. And I think the last bit on this tackle height that I want to touch on is the ramifications around the world. So Alan Gilpin confirmed that a form of rollout of this is going to follow in world rugby through the community game. There was some announcements, I think, in the Telegraph commenting that this would also follow into the pro game. That has now been reneged or clarified as incorrect as such. And, you know, what are you hearing is the eventual sort of future of the game from the community worldwide, but also what might happen in the higher leagues as well?
So, yes, as we understand it, there is World Rugby moving towards introducing a similar global law trial for the community game. They're on a different timetable with a different process, but there's a big meeting in March and another one in May, which is likely to sign this off. Now, the RFU, again, I said they were trying to do the right thing with this. They've gone first. They've taken all the heat, but they wanted to do it now so that the English clubs, players, referees had a chance to adapt to this before the start of next season, which is September time, rather than risk it coming in as a global law trial in January, which is often when World Rugby's law trials come in and it'd be dropped on them mid-season. So the RFU have taken all the heat here, when actually there is a move towards doing this and around the world at community level. You're right, there were reports of it being on the cards at test level, at pro level. Not at the moment, is my understanding. I think we feel, if you talk to people around the game, you feel that at some point down the line, when the evidence is collated from the mouth guards, the instrumented mouth guards that they're using, when as the detail builds up in the studies, that the conversation will happen down the line at some point about the pro game. Now, obviously, the pro game, those guys, they play more matches than the community game. They, you know, in England, there's a limit on 30 matches per season. My old club, community club, when I left, because I moved house, they had two adult men's teams. They've now got one, but they used about 45 players last season because people don't play as many matches anymore. So a pro player will play 30 games a year and train every day and therefore be liable to more contacts. But the medical provision and the protection around them is greater than it is at the community game. That's why the pro game is being treated differently with different research and therefore a different decision will be made. So my sense is that this conversation over reducing the tackle height in the pro game to the sternum will come down the line at some point. But it's not imminent. There are no plans in World Rugby to do this now. They're still working on sanctions as their means to try and drive the tackle height lower. Now, there's a whole other conversation there, probably for another podcast, about whether we think that's working or not. I think it's massively changing games, and you've got to argue whether it's working, particularly some of the reds that have been given. Are they being given to the right player? Is the player over the ball in the ruck too low? Loads of factors going on here. Loads of discussion points over whether sanctions are working to reduce the tackle height. But the fact of the matter is that remains World Rugby's policy for dealing with this right now. Law change is not on the cards imminently, but we expect it will be at some stage down the line.
It's interesting, isn't it? Like, because eventually you're going to get a whole crop of the next generation playing a different format of the game in the fact, because one of the things is obviously the tackle height might change. The big other thing that I think is going to be a difference is the dip and what's allowed from the ball carrier. And that's going to take a lot of retraining in the professional game too. Even if they drop the height to the navel or the navel or to the sternum, or potentially I think the nipple, the chest area is probably more realistic in the pro game with the size of the players and the whatever. But the issue is going to be, what does the ball carrier do? How much dip is he allowed? How different is that going to make the game? And then, you know, you're going to have a whole new generation of players playing a different style. Then they're going to come up to the professional game and then have to go back to the old ways. It feels inevitable that at some point that change is going to trickle down. But I appreciate your insight on the tackle height and where we got to. And I think, you know, this is an ever-evolving story, which I'm sure next week we'll probably have some more news to touch on. But it is also crazy, as we have so much to talk about with the Six Nations as well.
Just lastly on this, then, that one of the interesting elements of it is the drive for rugby to perhaps become more of an evasion game than a contact game, or maybe go back to becoming more of an evasion game than a contact game. Now, I think at community level, it largely is. I mean, as much as, certainly as you go down the pyramid, you know, you've got big lads who aren't that nimble anyway. But that was one of the key lines in the original announcement, was for rugby to be an evasion sport, not a collision sport. So you look for space, not for bodies. And they want to drive down the tackle height, and so that you, as a way of trying to deliver that, and therefore have fewer head-on-head or face-to-face collisions. It's an interesting sort of philosophical debate as to whether rugby can ever be a fully evasion sport when you've got some lads in there and women whose role is to drive through their opponent and get the team on the front foot. So, lots to discuss about this in the coming years, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With the emphasis on gain line, it's inevitable. And then the other thing that'll be interesting is what happens with the vote of no confidence in Bill Sweeney as well. And does that keep progressing, or has this apology and all that sort of, you know, quieted that down? I think TBD, and we can cross that bridge, when we get to it. But that's a wrap on the Tyker Height stuff, mate. Alex, thanks so much for that insight. All right, well, that is Tackle Height sort of done and dusted. Not the greatest moment for the RFU. They'll be looking to try and maybe change headlines this weekend as they take on Scotland at Twickenham to kick off the Six Nations. And to go through that and the latest developments, we have Alex Lowe continuing on the pod. And before we get into all the Six Nations chat and everything on the pod as well, got to give a shout out to USA Women's. Last week, we had Cheddar Ember and Sam Sullivan on, and they went out in Sydney and they managed to pull out a bronze medal, keeping them in Olympic qualification, sitting nice and pretty, consistently going for a medal every tournament so far this year. So got to give them a shout out. Congrats to the girls. Onwards they roll. It wasn't the strongest tournament for the boys, but at the same time, they are still in a good place with their Olympic qualification. If you didn't catch it, all the sevens is on Peacock TV on demand. You can watch it on replay whenever you want. Now it's time to dive in with the rest of the show.
All right.
Let's get into actually the rugby on the field, Alex, and, you know, stuff that's worth talking about. We spent a lot of time talking about the tackle height, but, you know, from your point of view, England, opening weekend of the Six Nations, new head coach in Steve Borthwick, new defence coach, new attack coach, coming in at Scotland at home, you know, what are you hearing out of the England camp and what should we be expecting this weekend?
Well, I think, first of all, the last section, sort of the segue from the last section to this section, sums up rugby at the moment and has done for a while, that we talk so much about issues and problems and challenges, but then we talk about the game and the Six Nations, and this is what we love about it. This is why we play the game, why we talk about the game and report on it, because there's a sense this is the week where the excitement starts to build. You're building towards the Calcutta Cup at Twickenham with everything new for England. You know, they've got an overhauled squad, some very familiar players, but Steve Borthwick has brought in some new players. I would expect him to play some of those new players against Scotland. As we touched on earlier, he's tried to change the mindset and the mood around the national team. He wants Twickenham to be excited again on their feet. He's recruited Nick Evans, the Harlequins attack coach, to be England's attack coach for this Six Nations. And they've talked a really good game. Everything they want to... They want people to be uplifted and excited by the England team heading into the Six Nations. I think they are, but they haven't played a game yet. And so that's where the excitement turns into like tingling anticipation, because England have beaten Scotland once in the last five games, which is unheard of in the Six Nations era. It's pretty much unheard of in our lifetimes. I mean, Scotland have got the rub on England at the moment. Scotland have won three and drawn one of those five games. And that draw at Twickenham felt like a defeat to England because they were 32-0 up or something and end up 37-all draw. Remarkable game. So there's excitement there. There are new players. I'd be very surprised. I mean, we're talking here on Monday. England squad will be reduced on Tuesday evening and the team will be named on Thursday. But I've got a feeling that a player like Ollie Hassell-Collins could make his debut for England against Scotland. Scotland are a frustrating team, and I'm sure you'll get further insight on them coming up, because they've got the players you think they could make a difference. They've got a player like Finn Russell. They're tight. Their pack are really strong. Their front row is good. We saw what Pierre Schumann did to Saracens just last weekend. their back row, Jamie Ritchie, Hamish Watson. They've got players. This is no easy opening game for Steve Borthwick. But in some ways, it's a great opening game because it's Scotland at home. And he can go out and start to show the public what it is that he wants his England team to be. And to answer your, this is a long-winded way of answering your question, what we expect. I expect something similar, actually, to when Eddie Jones took over in 2016. He took over a team that had just bombed out the World Cup. Public support was wavering, but he brought in a purpose and a clarity and a direction. That team went and won the Grand Slam with pretty much the same group of players. They knew what they were doing. Everyone had a job. James Haskell got picked and was just told, go and smash people. That is your job. Be our enforcer. Go and do it. He did it. And it was that was his role in that team. And they won the Slam. Now, I'm not predicting England are going to win the Slam, but I think they're going to play with that same clarity. I think if you recall, even the summer tour, or last Six Nations, the summer tour to Australia, the November series, in attack, England were muddled. They were confused. They didn't know. And Steve Borthwick has referenced this himself. When the heat came on, they didn't know how to get themselves out of a hole because they didn't know what they were supposed to be, what they were being asked of by the coaches. Basically, there was no clarity, and you could see that in how they were playing. Steve Borthwick will bring clarity. It may not be all that expansive. I think Nick Evans's role will be to speed up the breakdown, speed up the ball in attack so that they can at least try and catch the defence off guard. And on that sense, you wonder if Marcus Smith might play or Alex Dombrandt might play. So he'll have an influence, but it's not going to be all singing, all dancing rugby, but there'll be a clear strategy that I reckon you and I and everyone else watching will be able to pick up really quickly in the game, because you won't have players colliding into each other or running conflicting lines or anything like we've seen before. It'll be clear, and the players will know their roles, which from everything we hear wasn't the case in November.
It's fascinating that you can get to the highest level of the game and those things be an issue. And I think, you know, this game, when I look at it for England, it is massive because, you know, this is a team that could go one of two ways. They could win this game, win it ugly, doesn't matter. Then they have Italy. Then they have a fallow week. Then they roll into the big games. Slip up here and it's an uphill battle because you'll get the game against Italy, you should win, and you'll get a bit of form and confidence. But then you're immediately on the back foot, where I think if they can get some wind in their sails with a win today, it turns their prospects in this competition around. You know, they've got France at home, which is a big game in this series. When you play the blue teams at home, it always helps. And then, you know, they've got some big road trips in Cardiff and Dublin, which is going to be a tough one. I think both of those will be tough because I think Wales, I'm expecting to be better in this competition. Ireland are red hot at the moment. France are a menace. And Scotland, to me, are always that dark horse. Like you said, in my time as an England player, I never lost to Scotland. Never really feared it other than when we would have a very bad day at the office or a complacent game that was really going to be the case. Where now, it's game on. Scotland I think Scotland's scrum was much better than England's in the autumn. You know, England got to turn that round. I think Scotland's pack can go toe-to-toe with England. Their back line is menacing. Finn Russell's back in there and seems to hopefully have squared it away with Gregor, and that relationship seems to be in a better place. He's coming off, you know, a game-winning kick on the weekend, 24 points and a big win for Rassing. Like, all the stars to me are aligning for Scotland. And I think, you know, if I was a betting man, you'd almost think that Scotland have a right to be considered the favourites. Do I think England have the team to win that game? Absolutely. I think they can stomp the yard with their physicality. I think it's going to be interesting selection and which way they go. I think back row and the lock balance of, does he go another lock in that back row, like a six kind of lock, or does he just go for out and out, you know, dynamism, who he picks at eight, and his two flankers and his bench is fascinating to me. And then last, like you said, Marcus Smith, or is it Owen Farrell, back to the old way? Henry Slade is now going to miss this game, which is a big knock-on effect to probably the back line that they were probably hoping to have at the beginning of the tournament. And then
Lastly, the other issue for me with England is hooker. Is Jamie George going to play? If he plays, surely if he can't train fully until Thursday, his chances of starting are very small. If he is starting, that's a big call. But it's also a sign of the lack of depth and desperation. They have a little bit of hooker with no other talisman, no Cowan Dickey, Jack Walker in the wings, who could be starting his test debut. You know, in a team that needs to turn around the scrum, needs to be very bang on at set piece. Or you've got Tom Dunn, who's got a few caps. Or do you roll Jamie George out and say, well, we need him. This is a big game and we have to get it right. It very interesting to me how selection is going to follow this.
Yeah, for sure. And one of the things that's often said about England is they've got so many players. There is always an alternative, a very high quality alternative, which is true. But you mentioned it there. At hooker, where's the depth? England have played, like, Jamie George and Luke Cowan-Dickey started something like 95% of the games under Eddie Jones, one or the other. Tight head prop, you know, Dan Cole has come back in 3.5 years after he was dropped off to the World Cup final. There isn't a great depth chart of tight head props. Inside centre has been a problem position for England, which is one of the reasons why Owen Farrell has played so much at 12 for England, because they don't have an André Esterhazy type figure who stands alongside Marcus Smith for Harlequins as his foil. Manu Tuilagi has been in and out for 10 years because of injury. He's back in now and is therefore an option at 12, but he's played a lot at 13. You know, England have got some really exciting back three options. Loads of pace and power. Ollie Hassel-Collins, Caden Murley, Tommy Freeman, Max Malins, Elliot Daly's unfortunately injured now, despite playing. He's been playing so well for Saracens. The back row, so many good options. Not an enormous amount of test experience depth, but a group of players who I think are all high quality with test potential.
Yeah.
Jack Willis is carving up for Toulouse now. Ben Earl is back in. Ben Curry's back in. My sense, your point about do they go for a line-out six or a sort of a breakdown operator. With Courtney Laws out injured, my sense is they'll go, particularly against Scotland, they'll go for two players to really, really target the breakdown against Scotland. So a Ben Earl and a Jack Willis, or a Jack Willis and a Ben Curry. Perhaps with a, and then Simmons or Dombrandt at number eight. That's my sense this early in the week. I wouldn't be at all surprised if he goes with Marcus Smith and Owen Farrell. And that might be as much to do with, well, what are your best alternatives? If Owen Farrell is your best 10 and your best 12, if you play him at 10, who do you play at 12 and 13? Manu didn't have a great autumn. He didn't really bust the gain line. He's got it all to prove again. Whereas if you play Smith and Farrell, you've got if they determine, which I think they do believe Farrell's the best 10 and 12, then you've got the best 12 and the second best 10, and the drop off isn't as much. Admittedly, massively different players. So yeah, so I wouldn't be surprised if we get to the team announcement on Thursday and he sticks with Smith and Farrell. I think we'll go with two breakdown operating flankers. Breakdown targeting flankers, and then probably some new blood on the wings. Hassel-Collins is a player who I wrote this the other day, but Steve Borthwick has signed him for Leicester and picked him in an England Six Nations squad in the course of the same season, which is a pretty unique double. And he could give him the hat trick if he picks him for his debut against Scotland, but it's not actually been announced yet, but our understanding is that Hassel-Collins will join Leicester next season, having been signed by Borthwick before Borthwick joined England.
No, I agree. I expect to see him out there. And yeah, I've heard that he's going to Leicester as well, unofficially for a while, has been the word coming out. So, you know, it seems to all line up. And I think that's a good way to sort of cap this chat on England and the Six Nations, is like, you know, there's a lot of options and it's going to be sort of very newsworthy which way they go with selection and how they play, and, you know, how much of a change they make from the autumn with such a must-win game on their doorstep this weekend. It sets up fascinating stuff and why we love the Six Nations. But Alex, you know, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Anytime, Corbs, you're more than welcome.
Good to get his perspective on where England are. Lots of sort of question marks to be answered this weekend in Murrayfield. And as we continue to look at that game, we're actually really blessed to have a Scotland international on the pod in person. Blair Cowan, former Scotland international, now playing at the San Diego Legion in San Diego in the MLR, where I coach. Able to get him on the show, and I think he's got some really good insights. Let's get into it.
All right, and we are joined, luckily enough, on this scrum down in person. I thought it was very valuable to get a Scotland point of view on the pod. We've talked from England, we've talked from Ireland, and I thought, you know, Blair Cowan being in San Diego, Scotland international, my good mate as well. Blair, welcome to the scrum down, mate.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
It's good, mate. It's good. Thanks so much. And we were just talking off camera, but for me, the thing that blows me away is, you know, Alex Lowe touched on the show as well. 1 from 5 England are in Calcutta Cups. Like, Scotland have swung the balance of power in their favour. Yes, they're travelling to Twickenham this year, but from a Scotland point of view, like, you've got to be licking your lips. New England coach, uncertainty around some of the team and the selection, and you've kind of got a bit of the bragging rights at the moment as well.
Yeah, obviously being based in the Premiership for all these years, it's been a luxury to have those bragging rights and see the boys do so well. And I guess I heard Billy Bonapola talking the other day, and when he was asked what's the one team, you know, that means the most to you right now to beat, it was a huge compliment for, to say, Scotland. You know, Billy's one of the best number eights in the world. He's been a top England player for as long as I've been in the Premiership, which was like 10 to 15 years ago. And for him to say a statement like that, it's a huge testament to Scotland and how far they've come, and obviously how much they get under the English skin as well.
Well, I think that's one of the things. Scotland are always sort of niggly with England. I think, you know, I've played at Murrayfield, and like, they really sort of harness that brave heart spirit of like the English invaders as such. And there's no question the emotional energy is high when they play England. But I think when you look at Scotland, like, especially their starting team, it's a hell of a team. Like, the back line's money. Like, they got a good pack. Their scrum is good. I think England are going to have their hands full at scrum time with Scotland at the moment. I think, you know, with Ferguson, Schumann, like, they're a well-oiled machine. They got size. Like, all the little things that when you played Scotland, you never were. Like, I never feared their scrum. Like, now I actually worry about it for England.
Yeah, I think that's one of the perks of probably having the smaller player pool that Scotland has compared to England, is that the smaller squad over the years has grown together, and they've figured a lot out together and actually grew in confidence and now understand is that they are a top scrum. They do have some of the greatest playmakers in the world at the moment. I mean, you've got how many British and Irish Lions now? So they always had talent, but they probably lacked a little bit in confidence. But growing together and now achieving things like the Calcutta Cup 5 years, British and Irish Lions, they all now play with that confidence and trust in themselves and each other. And you can see it in the way they perform. I think they're still slightly, they always seem to rise to England.
Yeah.
They always, but for the rest of the Six Nations, they've got to learn how to reset almost, you know, off the big games. And that's probably been their biggest challenge over the years, is like they can take down world beaters on any day, but it's the consistency that they're still slightly not there with. But they always bring it for England.
Yeah.
Which at the end of the day, that's why.
I think that's what most of them are. And that's when you play for England, like literally, you know, pretty much every team, you are the game that they want to win that year. And it's one of those things, but I think you hit the nail on the head. Consistency for me is the big question mark on Scotland. Like this weekend, the way it lines up, like, I honestly think England on paper have a great team, and you know there's going to be continuity. I think Steve Borthwick's an incredible coach, but I do think Scotland deserve to be slightly favoured. Like, I know it's at Twickenham, but like England weren't great in the autumn, and there's only so much you can improve in 2 weeks together with new coaches. Where I think that continuity coming in is going to favour Scotland. And the other thing that I think is Finn Russell's back in the Ten shirt. Him and Gregor have like found a way to patch it up, to make it work, whether it be injury or whatever. But Finn is on silky form. I think he got 24 points on the weekend, kicked the winner in a big game for Racing. He's coming in form. Like, touch a little bit. You've played with Finn Russell. Like, what he's like, and also maybe a bit of your thoughts on his dynamic with Gregor.
Yeah, well, funny enough, me and Finn, we both debuted together here in the States, in Houston, in 2014.
What's that game?
And I always remember seeing him and the swag he had for someone who hadn't been capped. And it wasn't arrogance, it was just he knew himself. And it was something I always envied about Finn. He's never questioned himself, and he's got his own things that help him get through, his own triggers that will help get through the tougher stuff. And people probably perceive them as like arrogant or not caring, but like his smiling and his casual approach. But I've been around Finn, been around him in 2020, and when I was brought back up to the Autumn Series, Finn doesn't mess around. Finn knows his stuff. He does his homework. He's passionate. When he trains just as hard as anyone there. And then you combine that with his just ridiculous natural instinct for the game, and his talent, obviously, with his jouer, his offloads, his kick game, his short kick game. But it is a balancing act when it comes to Finn. It's kind of like when you go to the movies, and you got sweet popcorn and you got salt popcorn. And it's how you get that right balance when you put them together, and it's just perfect for the movie. And that's how I sort of see Finn. When you can get him, you know, doing exactly what he needs to do with the team without pulling or holding him back from what he offers best, that's when Scotland are most dangerous. And that's when they're the most exciting too. Gregor, but lucky enough to be involved with Gregor, my last Scottish cap. He's very detailed and he knows the game, and we certainly had a process to follow by, but he also knows Scotland's strength lies in their unpredictability and allowing, taking the shackles off, letting them go, and that's Finn right there. And so I personally didn't see the rift. I read about it in the papers when I wasn't there, and seen people speculate about it in the press and that, and I'm sure there was probably something, but When it comes right with Finn and he gets the team firing the way that he knows he can, everyone knows it's a different beast. And you've got an abundance of talent around there, you know, like Harris and Hoggy and Ali Price. Yeah. I mean, it's deadly back line.
That back line is just scary good, mate. Yeah. Scary good. And their pack is no, like I said, is respectable. And that's why I think like England better roll their sleeves up and know that they're on for a scrap here, mate. Because like traditionally, they usually do well with the blue teams at home. You know, when you play, England always get Italy, Scotland and France at home. And that's usually when they have their better Six Nations results. But mate, France at home is going to be no walk in the park. And I'm telling you, Scotland is no walk in the park. And that's why this game is so big for both teams, because it just sets the other team up on a roll where the other team has got a massive lift to get back in the mix after dropping this one, knowing you've still got to play Ireland, France, and even Wales. I think with Gats back, are going to be much better than we've probably seen as well. Point to prove. Honestly, the Six Nations could go a million different ways. Like I think Ireland and France are probably two clear favourites, but whoever comes out of this is in the mix to go four wins at least and be in that final finish.
Yeah, what an exciting Six Nations this one is. Probably the most unpredictable one. I mean, I'd say France are still heavy favourites, France, Ireland. But they're all, everyone on their day at the moment. And the uncertainty about England, I find it horrible.
I know.
Eddie's gone, and I personally think that's a good thing for England. You know, like, he had his early shelf life that was... it was really effective. Everyone sort of fell in line and played really well. But obviously, the Autumn Series wasn't good, and it was so close to the World Cup. It was a ballsy move by the board, to be fair, but they did it. And I think they got the right man for the job. And he's proven it already with Leicester, and he's proven it with England in the past. And he's got that respect. He doesn't need to build that trust it seems that, like, I'm just saying from a spectator's point of view, it looks like he's already got that trust from the players.
No, 1,000%.
And I think by the look of the likes of him getting Coles back in, you can kind of see where he's heading with this. You know, he's going to go set piece first.
Got a restoring than set piece, mate.
Probably going to tighten up the kicking game a tad. Yeah. But he's also got to recognise the talent he's got in that squad where they can run the ball.
Yeah.
And look, when they were chasing games, how good England can be when they chase a game.
And he's brought Nick Evans in, which makes me think that's a move to play. Like, look at how Quinn's play. Like, I don't think that's a kick. I don't think you're going to bring Nick Evans in if you're going to play like maybe how Leicester won the league, which is a bit more, you know, kick, defence, percentages-esque. Like, I feel like Nick Evans is there to open the attack up and give clarity. So, you know, fingers crossed from an England point of view. It's going to be a good one, mate, like you said. But Blair, I really appreciate your insight. I think the last thing I want to get from you is maybe a prediction on the weekend.
That's a tough one. I feel it's going to be a higher scoring game than you'd expect. I'm going to go 28-26 Scotland.
Ooh, I like it. I'm going to go 21-18 to England.
You just said before you reckon they're favourite Scotland.
I know, mate, but I couldn't go against the boys. I had the favourite. You got England. I think it's going to be close. I honestly think it could go either way, mate. Yeah. Like it generally could. Like, I haven't looked at the betting spreads yet or anything, but I'm assuming it's going to be a very close spread in that game. Because how do you call it? You know what I mean? And then how do you judge England? Like, their form in the autumn, like we said, wasn't great, but look at the team on paper, mate. Like, the team on paper is money. So, and they got new coaches, good coaches coming in. And I think they're going to have a fire under them a little bit. Like, when you look at 2015, bombed in the home World Cup, Eddie came in, only had 2-3 weeks with the team. They won the Grand Slam. Do you know what I mean? Yep. So it's like, is that possible with the talent England have? Yes. But TBD, how it all goes.
I think with a lot of new coaches that come in, you've always got that advantage of, from a player's point of view, everyone's ready to get into line quickly initially, because you don't have time to play with understanding the coach. Where you've got to step up and do exactly what he's saying and sort of fall in line with what they want to do. And I think that happened with Eddie. You know, boys were like, oh, I've got to, you know, and it had that effect. I think people may have got a bit... It might have become a bit more mundane over time, and which you've seen the performance drop. I don't know, maybe.
Yeah.
But certainly with Borthwick, I think there will be almost like a vitality, like a fresh sort of like impact, and everyone's keen and might hit the ground running, and optimism is always peaks with new coaches. So I think they will be dangerous. And England are England. They're always going to be.
Yeah. At Twickenham, too. Twickenham, it's hard to lose at Twickenham with the crowd and stuff. You've got to play bad to lose.
100%.
But anyway, mate, it's an absolute pleasure having you on the pod. Super. Thanks for your time, bro. And I'll definitely be seeing you soon.
Safe.
Cheers, brother.
Like, how much of a G is Blair Cowan? Like, honestly, love being in a team environment with him, but I thought he spoke really well. Great insight, amazing perspective from a Scotland team. And as I said, they deserve all the applause they're getting on this pod. I think, you know, 1 from 5 from England in the Calcutta Cups is a crazy stat. And I think, you know, that's why I think Scotland should be favoured. I did predict England because I can't do my boys dirty like that. But I think it's going to be a cracker of a game. But as we continue talking about the Six Nations, it's time to get into it with our guest, Luke Fitzgerald, former Ireland international, host of the Left Wing podcast. Lots to talk about. Let's get to it.
And we are joined, finally making his return back to the Scrum Down, one of the originals back in the day. You should know him. Luke Fitzgerald, former Ireland international, the main man with the Left Wing podcast as well. Make sure you check that out. And a good friend of mine as well, mate. So welcome. Good to have you back on the Scrum Down.
Man, it's been way too long. As you said, one of the originals. Really, really good to see. It's been way too long. You're looking good. You're looking beefy again. Looks like you're hitting the weights, training hard again, I'm sure.
Yeah, for sure, mate. I think now that I'm coaching and San Diego Legion are in season, this, you know, gets you in the gym more and gets you back into it, and you know, gets the juices flowing, seeing the lads graft and stuff. So I'm definitely finding a bit of motivation there, mate. And, you know, how are things with you? How's the left wing going? It's great to see. I feel like the scrum down had a good, like, origin story for where the left wing started, like getting our pods together and then you getting your own. I think it's just been amazing to see.
Yeah, we're survivors, aren't we, Corbs? Yeah, we're survivors, aren't we, Corbs? That's for sure. Yeah, no, it's great. Yeah, no, it's been trucking along nicely. A few hiccups here and there, but
the early retirees, mate.
But no, it's been great. We've got a nice kind of loyal enough listenership, and great support from the we're supported by the independent newspaper. So things are going really well. I mean, look, it's a nice period. I mean, you know, Leinster have been very strong over the last couple of years, and Ireland have been pretty strong too. There's good stories there, and rugby is kind of in a good place in Ireland, which I'm sure we'll get into over the course of the scrum down.
I agree, mate. I think you hit the nail on the head, and that's really why I wanted to bring you on. Is, you know, we've covered a lot of the England, a bit of Scotland in this pod, but I wanted to get the Irish perspective because for me, you guys, if I look at the tournament, you're my betting favorite right now. Like I think the two home games, France and England at home, for me, gives you guys a real shot to go nail this down. Who knows, Grand Slam in these competitions is so hard, but I do think Ireland's in a good place. Leinster are firing, Munster finding their feet as well. And I just think the national team, the cohesiveness, the coaching staff, it's all upward trajectory trending towards this year's World Cup. And I think the big question is, like, you know, just making sure Ireland didn't peak too soon, like maybe we've seen in other years where, I think, was it 2018? Probably one of the best teams in the world, and 2019 World Cup didn't go to plan. I think that's probably the only question mark, is making sure that continues through the season. But with the way Leinster and everyone else is going, I only see it being the strong Six Nations for Ireland.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. Yeah, we've been in this situation before where we've kind of mistimed the run, as you mentioned. My sense is this might be a little bit different. But I mean, who knows? I mean, I think the soundings from the camp are very positive. They are trying to target this Six Nations, which I think is actually really important. I mean, I know it's not necessarily strongly correlated to a good performance. You know, you look at South Africa, say, in the last World Cup and the championship disaster they had before the World Cup, and they managed to get it back together. So I don't think it's necessarily correlated. But what I do think is I'd much rather be in a good position and playing good rugby in the Six Nations than not. I think that South Africa thing might be a bit more of a one-off than not. And I think good momentum coming in would be very positive for this team. And I think they don't need to be afraid of talking themselves up, I think, particularly as you mentioned briefly, the fixture list is probably pretty favourable. I like that they get England later on in the competition. I'd like to see a little bit of what Borthwick brings. I think he's a really good selection. You know, seems like an excellent coach. And I'd like to see them play a few games. I wouldn't like to play them cold and have them look at all of Ireland's good performances. So I think, yeah, it's France and England are at home are always years when the Irish team are playing well that there's a little bit of positivity around the place. We don't like getting too far ahead of ourselves, but I think this Irish team is in a very good place.
I agree, mate. And what I like about it is it's just so much like clarity and continuity in the team. Like talking about England over the last year or two, it's looked so muddled at times. They've had coaches turnover, you know, different types of systems trying to be implemented. It's sometimes been hard to nail down how they play. But what I love about Ireland is, you know how they play. They have a system. They're really good on it. It's very much continuity from how Leinster play. You've got great coaches in who've been in these positions for a long time. Like, the continuity is there. And you've started to build some depth in that squad as well, which has always been maybe one of the question marks of Ireland, is if a few key players go down, does the ship go down? Where I think you guys have had a few of those years where you've had to blood guys, or guys have had to play when there's been injuries, and you actually are stacked pretty deep in a few key areas as well, which I think, you know, for me, means that this tournament, you know, could be the one as such for you boys. I obviously want England in that last game to turn it round. I think Borthwick and that coaching staff is going to add a lot to that team. But it's very hard with no runway to get to the level that Ireland have been able to get to with those years under Paul O'Connell, years with Farrell there. Like, there's just so much continuity and detail that I find it hard not to be a fan of them at the moment.
Yeah, and look, I think there's an awful lot of belief after the summer series win in New Zealand. I think a lot of talk of, you know, echoes of maybe that that English tour under Clive Woodward that, you know, before 2003, you know, and the confidence that that team gained from going down there. And I think this Ireland team was in a similar place. Well, what I would say is there's still probably a little bit of worry about Johnny Sexton. I think, look, his age profile, like, you know, if Johnny Wilkinson or Dan Carter would have gone down in those, you know, in all those years, that would have had a massive impact on those teams too. But it's probably less likely given their age profile in these parts when the teams are competitive and playing well. You know, just a little bit better and probably a little bit more durable. So that's always a concern with this Irish team. I think Johnny Sexton is playing unbelievable rugby. He still looks to be in fantastic condition, but look, he is older. And, you know, when you talk about turnover, I think, you know, Joey Carberry out of the team is a little bit of, it's late movement. Now, I think it's based on form because I think Ross Byrne is playing better for Leinster, you know, and I think he absolutely deserves his call-up. I think he was treated very harshly by management over the last couple of years, particularly before the last World Cup. So it'll be interesting to see if he gets much game time. I think that's actually going to be essential for Ireland, that they get the number two, whoever they deem that is, to get some game time. And then as well, we have one up-and-comer, and looks to be a bit of a bolter in Jack Crowley. So my focus is on that 10 position, but it's for good reason. I think it's that age profile with Johnny. And I'd probably still be a little bit concerned maybe about Tadhg Furlong. He is such an important part of this Irish team. And yeah, he just seems to be picking up some niggly injuries too. So we need those two guys to have nice, clear run-ins and you know, injury-free periods before that World Cup. And hopefully they build up a bit of durability, because if they don't play throughout the competition, and I'm thinking particularly that South Africa match in the tour in the warm-up, and then obviously if we get through the group stages, it looks like we have France or New Zealand. We will need all of our best players on the paddock for that one, Corbs, as you well know. And those two guys, I think it's still a different team if they're not in it. So we do need a little bit of luck injury-wise for those key guys. I think they are in excellent condition. As you said, just in the wider squad, certainly they've built an awful lot of depth. And Munster coming back into some good form, and we hope Ulster return to some good form, you know, I think probably bodes well. You need three of the four teams to be playing at least at a very high level for Ireland to be competitive and to be building quality throughout the wider squad.
No, I agree with you, mate. I think that's probably the two areas where the depth is the shallowest, and they're big name players at 10. The thing with Byrne coming in is you get that continuity from Leinster. So I always felt like if you're not going to have Sexton, in my mind, always bringing in the guy who's getting the minutes at Leinster seems to make sense when they're playing so well. And then with Tag, I think Beetham has come a long way. I think you know, a year or two ago, I had question marks if he would be like Test tight head material, but I think he's really started to come on and show. He had some great scrums in the autumn. I thought against South Africa, held his own a couple times as well, and that's a big step up from where I'd seen him maybe a year before. But I do agree, props are always the issue. England have got issues at prop, especially at tight head, finding depth at the moment. And I think if you look at Ireland this weekend, like, what do you expect, you know, from the game against Wales? It's hard to know exactly what to expect from Wales with Gatlin, some changes, but also with Gatlin, sometimes he just keeps it simple and you almost know what you're getting. It's an interesting one.
Yeah, I think it's a real banana skin. It's why I mentioned the getting England later in the competition is kind of reassures me just a little bit, because, you know, when a new coach comes in, there's genuinely, you know, I genuinely think there's always, nearly always, a lift unless they're pretty poor. But we know both of those coaches are excellent from what I can see. You know, Gatland has an envious track record and always seems to be able to pull something out of his teams and make them very, very competitive. And we know what Wales are like in the Millennium Stadium. Just, you know, anything can happen there. They seem to bring their best rugby, and no matter how bad all of the provinces are playing, in the United Rugby Championship, they always seem to come together well for Wales. Now, Pivac kind of wasn't really able to, I suppose, produce the same kind of magic that Gatland was, and maybe the likes of Sean Edward not being there, Rob Howley, maybe things will change. So it might be difficult for him to be able to turn it around this time without all of the pieces of the puzzle that he had previously. But I still think Gatland is, as you say, he's kind of a simple coach, but that's not to detract from the ability that he has. Because oftentimes in rugby, we know a simple game plan gets buy-in. You know, it means that everyone understands what they're doing throughout the game. And all they really have to deliver then is on the mental side of things, which, you know, physically, you know, definitely physically anyway, in the Millennium Stadium, they'll be able to produce that. So I think it's a massive challenge for this Irish team. I think they'd love to have gotten them maybe a little bit later in the competition so that they can, you know, bed in some of that kind of attacking rugby, that you probably get more used to each other as the competition goes on. So I expect this one to be really tight. I think if Ireland can get over this one, I actually think they're in a really strong position, and I'd be way more confident about Ireland having a good Six Nations if they can get through this one. I think this is the big one for them, actually, weirdly enough. I know France are, look, that's a really tough challenge, but that's at home, and we're very difficult to beat at home as well. So this is a really big challenge for, in my mind, and one of the toughest matches of the championship.
It's hard to not agree with a lot of what you said. I think, you know, for Wales, I just think you just haven't had an identity. Under PVAC, there was flashes of you know, things that maybe you thought he was going to bring in from Scarlets or the way they wanted to play, but there just never seemed to be like a clear way I could tell you exactly how Wales were wanting to play. And I think that's with Gats. You usually, from watching, it becomes very obvious what his teams are trying to do. And that's why I think maybe getting back onto that sort of, you know, clarity or identity that Wales maybe have lacked for this World Cup cycle will hopefully be a benefit. I do think it's a big game for Ireland. Similar to, I think this Scotland game is a massive game for England, because I think it's just like, if England can get through this one, new team, changes at home, I do think then they have Italy, then they have another week and a fallow week, and then they run into those big three games. And it's similar that, you know, the first game can be such a banana skin, and then it dictates the whole outcome of the way that your Six Nations goes.
Yeah, it does. You know, from England's perspective, you know, I think it'll be hard for Borthwick to bed in, you know, all of what he wants to achieve so quickly. And that's going to be the challenge for him as a coach, is trying to figure out nearly what he wants to leave out and not what he wants to put in. And I think nearly there's a real skill, and I think it's what Gatland is always great at, particularly from his Lions experiences. He'll know how to get a team together in a short span. And that's why I think this is such a difficult one for Ireland. But on the flip side, can Borthwick do that? Can he figure out what's really important for this English team to go and produce? Because we know that there's massive depth. I know there's challenges in the English game at the moment around the clubs and the finances, but there's still huge resources there and loads of quality players and winners, people who are winners. So I think, you know, he has all the tools. He just needs to figure out, you know, how he makes this team competitive and how he can, you know, I think a result is probably more important for them at this stage, but, you know, what are his big bedrocks? What does he figure is the most important for this team to turn around from the November internationals? And he seems to have been very, very astute in his coaching career so far. So I expect him to deliver on that. And I think England could be dark horses here. I think they've got a difficult finish to the competition, but I think time, you know, is a big factor with this Borthwick changeover. And I think they'll get stronger as the competition goes on. It's just whether they can get over this initial one up in Murrayfield, which is, you know, they'll be baying for blood up there. And I think they might sniff an opportunity to turn England over. So what a weekend to start off the championship.
Oh, it's going to be good, mate. It's going to be good. Get me excited just talking about it. But I think, mate, that's a wrap on Ireland, Luke. We appreciate you coming on, mate. I'm sure we'll hear from you again as the Six Nations goes on, and you know, we can make some predictions the last week when it's that England-Ireland game. It's going to be a cracker.
Yeah, hopefully it all boils down to that one. That's always a cracker of a weekend in Dublin, and yeah, the Aviva will be rocking for that English team. If both team, I mean, imagine both teams coming in possibly, you know.
Oh, four of
possibly
four.
Unbeaten.
Yeah,
that has the potential. I feel England have our dark horses this year. So yeah, we wait and see. I think you know, Andy Farrell has his team in a great place. He has the trust of the players. His coaching staff are very settled, and he has, if his senior players, we talked about those guys, if they're fit, Ireland are bloody hard to beat. So yeah, so excited now for it. Just can't come quick enough, can it?
I agree, mate. I agree. It's going to be a good one, mate. All the best, and we'll speak soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Great to have Luke on. I think more good insight on the pod. I hope you enjoyed it. It's time to wrap up this show. We really appreciate it. Thanks to everyone from listening, liking, favoring, watching on NBC Sports YouTube. If you're watching this in video, we really appreciate all the support. Worked hard to get a good range of guests on this week to get some good insight. Hope you all enjoy it, and we'll see you again next week.